Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. This is episode 355. I'm the ghost Mark Ames. I am here in cold Lake Ontario, Rochester, New York. And I'm on the line with the War Nerd, Gary Bridger, aka John Dolan, in Trieste, Italy. John, how are you?
Pretty good. Looking forward to this show.
Very much, yes. We're just going to go straight to an interview we're really excited to get going with. Our guest today is Ryan Gingras, or Gingras, if you're into the whole Quebecois thing. Ryan is going to try and illuminate us about a big area of huge importance that we've been wanting to sort of discuss for a while now, which is Turkey, late Ottoman Turkey up through Erdogan. This episode, we're going to try and stick with the late Ottoman period. But let me just introduce Ryan first of all. He is the author of 6 books on the late Ottoman period up through the Turkish period up through, in terms of your books anyway, I guess a book covering the most recent period is, this is how I actually first heard of you, your book, Heroin, Organized Crime, and the Making of Modern Turkey. That one goes up to 1980. And we've done Years of Lead Italy series, a very popular series. And, you know, talk about deep state and Years of Lead stuff. Turkey has it in spades. Anyway, he's also author of the book, Fall of the Sultanate, The Great War and the End of the Ottoman Empire, which is going to be the main subject of our talk today. And his most recent book, it's just coming out now through Penguin Press, The Last Days of the Empire, that is to say the Ottoman Empire. It's also written on a book on Ataturk, which would be actually 2 books, Heir to the Empire, Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, and Eternal Dawn, Turkey in the Age of Ataturk. And several articles spanning from, the ones I've read anyway, going back historically, again, rebutting somebody who was basically sort of an Armenian genocide denier. And Ryan had a great article rebutting that whole thing, up through modern stuff, writing about Erdogan policy towards Greece, for example, and a potential impending war there. Anyway, first of all, after that long intro, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
First of all, thank you for the invitation, and thank you for that really warm and, you know, and exceedingly kind introduction. It's really humbling to hear that you've read all that stuff. I really thank you.
As I was saying, as we were saying a little bit before the show, and as I kind of alluded to, Turkey, look, we started this show in just without really thinking about it. There wasn't much podcasting going on, and we were just looking for a few extra bucks to make a little extra more money, because journalism is such a thankless, poverty-inducing job. So this is the fall of 2015 we started it. And actually the show, within a couple of months, the show kind of, really mushroomed, got a lot of subscribers. And the incident that kind of moved us to the next level was when Turkey shot down the Russian Sukhoi over Syria in October, November of 2015. And, one thing we've just keep coming back to is Turkey. I mean, historically, we've done an episode on Battle of Lepanto, for example. I mean, historically, the Ottoman Empire. But in modern times,
it comes into
Turkey,
so many of our stories. Yeah. Like when we were trying to do historical background for the war in Yemen. There's so much Ottoman background in there, which you discuss in your books. I mean, the quote that leapt out at us was the sardonic remark by some Ottoman proto-pundit that we have managed to find no better foundry for melting soldiers into corpses than Yemen.
Sounds about right.
So, to understand Turkey and to understand Erdogan, I mean, you know, we could start like hundreds and hundreds of years ago, but we're not obviously going to do that. We'd like to start where you started, really, and this will be just, we're going to try and confine today's discussion as much as possible to this period that you wrote about in the fall of the Sultanate, which is 1908 to 1922, which is the decline, you know, the last part of the decline, long, long Ottoman decline, but it really accelerates in a huge way, and things change in a huge way between 1908 and 1922, and that is the subject of the fall of the Sultanate. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about how, what went on then, how that still sort of informs a lot of stuff that maybe doesn't make a lot of sense to us today.
Sure.
So I guess the first thing we should do, we're going to try and stick to, you know, it's best to try and stick linearly as much as possible. Why did you start your book in 1908? And, you know, well, I guess it's obvious. I mean, the Committee of Union Progress, that's when they take power, the Young Turks. But what makes you start your book then? And who are the Young Turks? And how do they, I mean, if you could kind of bring us into that way. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, maybe it's the best place to start is why I wrote the book at all. And, you know, this basically came about as a result of a conversation and an invitation from Robert Gervard, who, if you've not heard of him or if you know, any of the listeners haven't heard of him, he is a wonderful scholar of, you know, generally speaking, the First World War era, although he's done a lot of really amazing work. He wrote a wonderful biography of Gerhard Heydrich, you know, Hitler's hangman. He's written a biography and a sort of general history of Bismarck, but most of his work is on sort of generally speaking the World War I era, Central Europe. And he, you know, was editing a series for Oxford, and he had reached out to me saying, "Do you want to write a history of, generally speaking, broadly defined, the war years at the very end of the Ottoman Empire?" And he said, "Pick whatever timeline you want, give whatever coverage you want, so long as it's somewhat regional, you know, and that you can maybe give readers a general sense of the kind of the inside out look of the ways and the events that define the end of the Ottoman Empire." And I was really excited about this because my biggest affection, the core of my affection for Ottoman history is provincial history. I mean, I love stories about, you know, small, you know, provincial places, you know, locales that not even necessarily are kind of found easily delineated on the map, right? That are defined by local cultures, defined by local peoples, or defined by events. And, you know, this kind of gave me that opportunity to be really indulgent and try to tell, you know, a kind of periphery in, you know, center out sort of story for the end of the Ottoman Empire. And in searching for a way to sort of tie in this, a history of, you know, what I thought would be the war years, I had to try to anchor it to a central thread. And the obvious thread that runs through the last several decades of the Ottoman Empire is, you know, as you foreshadow, is the Committee of Union and Progress, is the Young Turks. It is this regime that comes to power ostensibly in 1908, ostensibly falls in 1918, but in some ways, you know, kind of metamorphosizes into, you know, this movement that is dedicated to liberating the Ottoman Empire, that takes shape in 1919, succeeds in 1922, and the greatest irony of all is the force that ends the Ottoman Empire. It is the thing that fundamentally declares the Ottoman Empire dead. And then, you know, last but by far not least, it gives birth to Ataturk. It gives birth to Mustafa Kemal's movement, not just in terms of the party that launches his career, but, you know, provides the intellectual basis for his reforms and really the basis of what is, what defines so much of what is Turkey today. So, you know, in trying to sort of get my hands around the topic, I try to conceive of the book as a way of, first of all, telling a broader story about the Ottoman Empire, but weaving together these ways in which different parts of the Ottoman Empire witnessed or experienced the end of imperial rule, right? And it happens in lots of different ways. It happens often by conquest, but it also happens, you know, by, in essence, a kind of consent, right? That local peoples, by hook or by crook, you know, essentially denounce the empire or sort of repudiate it in some way. And that could take many different shapes. And one of the reasons why you have this experience, again, is really rooted in the policies and in the character of the Committee of Union and Progress, right? So the book takes you on a really deep dive in the development of this party, you know, and the way you have to begin that story is by, you know, taking somewhat of a brief journey through the 19th century, you know, through the travails of the 19th century. Now, you know, you've, you know, kind of alluded to, you know, Mark, the idea of decline, right? The idea that, you know, if you looked at it, the Ottoman Empire somewhat loosely, you know, or sort of, you know, kind of as a general survey, you can be forgiven for thinking about the Ottoman Empire as being in this period of maybe free fall isn't quite the right word, but certainly this period of degeneration, right? You could sort of mark the beginning of that at different points, but I think, you know, certainly by the 1800s, that is oftentimes the ways in which people think about the end of the empire as being at the tail end of this long standing tailspin. Now, from the perspective of people, however, inside the Ottoman Empire, that was not necessarily the case. Right. And this was not most certainly the case for this, you know, movement that takes shape around this political party called the Committee of Union and Progress. You know, they saw certainly the empire as imperiled, but this isn't necessarily a terminal crisis. Right. This is the 19th century can also be construed as the story of a country, of a people, of a government, of, you know, different movements dedicated to turning things around, right? And that, you know, this was the moment, you know, or these were years in which the darkness, you know, was beginning to break into the dawn, right? I mean, bad, you know, poorly executed metaphor there, but, you know, forgive me. At any rate, I mean, that there was a possibility that things were going to get better, right? But the means by which it was going to get better was government action, right? And this sort of gets to the heart of the story, is that the Committee of Union and Progress, this political party, which, you know, has somewhat of a convoluted origin story, which I will save your listeners, you know, the kind of their patience in listening to it. But suffice to say that, you know, begins to really congeal into a revolutionary force between 1907 and 1908. Summer of 1908, the party launches this, you know, uprising, forcing the Sultan to reinstate a constitution that had been consecrated in 1876. Now, this is an important moment in not just, you know, Turkish history, but I would say broadly speaking, Middle Eastern history, Balkan history, in that it marked a moment in which large numbers of people, one may say kind of a majority of Ottoman citizens, all of a sudden were filled with this, you know, these expressions of hope, you know, these sorts of these pangs of, you know, of anxieties that over sort of the present and the future kind of give way to a measured amount of hope that things were indeed turning around with the reinstatement of the constitution, with, you know, the emergence of this political movement. Right. Now, the book sort of takes that moment forward in looking at the ways in which the aftermath begins to bear, you know, sort of, you know, bear a certain number of let's say benefits for, you know, various types of people throughout the empire, but more than anything, kind of, you know, an emerging amount of antagonism and disappointment. And so as we, you know, kind of march through the succeeding years, you know, between from 1908 to 1911, which is the year in which Italy invades Libya, 1912, when the Balkan Wars break out, and then finally the First World War, this sense of hope turning into anxiety, you know, sort of returned anxiety and disappointment begins to grow. And that's kind of the central tension mm-hmm. of the book.
Yeah, it gets grim really fast. Yeah. It's a it's a brutal book. One thing I really appreciate about your book is that, I mean, you do your best to kind of get us in the head of, or to make us sort of try to understand what it felt like to be an Ottoman citizen and in different parts of the empire, whether it was the Arab parts or the Balkan parts or the Anatolian parts and different groups. It's you know, really quite eye-opening. But getting back to 1908 again, so a couple things I wanted to ask you about or bring up.
Sure.
One is, like, you know, you talk about this some, and it has echoes, I think, today, and it's just so fascinating to me, is the extent to which, I think primarily British, but say British and French creditors had, you know, Istanbul, like by the balls or whatever. I mean, and you know, we see this a lot these days. I kind of had thought that that sort of thing was more of a modern invention with some exceptions, but you know, it was when you owe debt to big imperial powers, you only have so much sovereignty. And so, you know, you can only do so much, and you create deep, profound grievances. I mean, again, I saw this with Russia, and that debt trap. How much did that debt trap sort of inform the Ottoman nationalism, which is an interesting, weird thing to say, right? Ottoman nationalism, but that's what it was at first, of the CUP. And second thing about the CUP, the Young Turks, is I was kind of surprised at how, in the very beginning, very, very beginning at least, like they were very considered very progressive and had a lot of like cross-sect allies, including with Armenians, right? With Armenians and
absolutely
Kurds and Arab nationalist groups, like they were. Now that changed pretty quickly. And then got really ugly after a while, but like they did have that big promise. But anyway, so yeah, the debt and the humiliation, I guess, and then about their sort of alliances with other, you know,
sure. I mean, I think first of all, you know, if you step back a little bit, you know, one of the traits of European imperialism in the late 19th century actually is economic aid of some way, shape, or form, right? And your suspicions are right that the makings of Ottoman nationalism, it may sound strange, but you have to understand, you know, one thing that happens by the 19th century, you know, not just in the Ottoman Empire, but everywhere, you know, is people are thirsting for identity.
Yes.
And Ottoman, yes. You know, Ottoman identity is, you know,
it's
does
a thing,
become a real
right?
thing. It becomes a real thing. But, you know, one thing that is both the strength and ultimately the weakness of Ottoman identity, Ottoman nationalism, is that it is something of an empty vessel, right? It has, you know, certain basic traits. What is it to be an Ottoman? Well, you know, you're born in the Ottoman Empire. You're a subject of the Sultan. You share, this sort of common sense of citizenship with others. Common, you know, sort of point of reference in terms of loyalty, But, you know, there is a lot more that's left to the imagination and left to the investment of the citizen. Now, you know, for the Young Turks, you know, the Young Turks really saw themselves as more than anything, the kind of the vanguard of the Ottoman nation, and saw themselves very much as the foremost nationalists in the empire. And I think especially, you know, if we've got a lot of Americans listening here in the audience, you know, we use the term nationalism as a pejorative. The Ottomans, Ottomans didn't use that. And most importantly, you know, people during the turn of the 20th century didn't think of a nationalist or nationalism in pejorative terms, right? It was a sort of state of being and a natural state of being. And, you know, for the Young Turks, you know, the fact that the Ottoman Empire was in hock to both private creditors in Europe, but also in hock to the great powers for other things too. You know, let's say military aid and training, the fact that, you know, so much of the education system was informed by, you know, European ideas, European precedents, European methods. It bred insecurity. And if you're going to sort of take that thread up to today, and I'm sort of sensing, Mark, you really would like to sort of take it up a little bit to today. You know, that sense of insecurity endures, right? It endures not just in Turkey, but I would say sort of broadly speaking, you know, this is a trait that we see throughout the Middle East and lots of places of the world, that so much of what is the making of state culture, state institutions, popular culture is of foreign origin and seemingly comes with this kind of debt that must be paid in some way, or that is the sense of being owned in some sort of way. This is a broad sense of, you know, of anxiety, or this is a generalized sense of anxiety that one finds. And specifically in Turkey, you know, you see it, you hear it harped upon quite a bit. Actually, just recently, you know, Erdogan cited the precedent of the Ottoman Public Debt Administration in boasting the fact that he would not ask Europeans for loans, right? Or ask the IMF or the World Bank for loans to help Turkey get out of its current crisis. Right. So it's an important historical reference, right? It's an important historical reference and something that is quite key to Ottoman identity building. Now, you know, you talked a little bit about, you know, where this, perhaps this thing fits within the broader alliance that the Committee of Union Progress builds, especially in the early stages. Well, one thing to bear in mind is that, you know, the Committee of Union Progress, first and foremost as an organization, understood that its success depended upon consensus. And the consensus that party leaders identified as being, you know, the thing that would carry them to victory was the restoration of the Constitution. The Constitution thus creating, the Constitution having created an elected parliament, having given greater power to obviously elected officials, but more importantly, taken to some degree power away from the Sultan. And so a variety of different actors saw this as a potential vehicle for political redress, right? Now, the Committee of Union Progress and its leaders, and here we get a little, we could get a little bit more in the weeds because it's somewhat essential. You know, it takes on this very clandestine,
very Bolshevik
infrastructure.
Kind of.
Well, Bolshevik in the sense that, you're right, in the sense that it was a party that was born out of a revolutionary movement, a clandestine revolutionary movement, and in becoming a public entity and in becoming a party that would stand for contested elections, it still did not shed this kind of clandestine culture. And it, this clandestine culture becomes ever more important as time goes on. And one thing that we learn, and I think is now abundantly clear, is that for all of it, the rhetoric of trying to build a national consensus, build a national consensus around the revolution, around the parliament, around the constitution. There is some degree of, let's just say, alienation within the party's sort of inner sanctum regarding large segments of the Ottoman population, right? That that these people were, that these groups are not going to be ultimately reconciled, even though at sort of this important moment in time, they've attracted Armenian and Greek and Jewish Arab supporters.
Yeah, I remember in another of your books, The Last Days of the Empire, an excellent book,
Thank you.
Describe one, let's say, Turkish commentator's remarks on the very nasty collapse of Smyrna, or as it's now called, Izmir. And I think it's Ali Kemal writing this, and he's writing about Nureddin Pasha, who was kind of a monster. And he says, yes, Nureddin Pasha was quite a monster. But, you know, there was a sense of inferiority among the Anatolian Muslim Turkish population toward these Greeks and these Armenians as well. And it there's a remarkably 1930s Germany sound to all that. Like, there's this feeling at once that these peoples are inferior and that they're super beings that you can't compete with on level ground.
Yeah, I mean, the actor, it, good memory. It actually wasn't Ali. It wasn't Ali Kemal. It was Falik Rifke, Atay, who was a stenographer for Ataturk, and you know, somebody who was also, again, a young Turk, who was a member of the Committee of Union Progress and a witness to lots of different things. And you know, the passage you're citing is that, you know, Izmir burned. You know, Izmir Smyrna burns in 1922 at the very end of, you know, this, you know, the ostensibly the end of the empire, because Turks were, you know, did feel insecure culturally and politically when it came to, you know, groups which eventually came to be called minorities, right? Which is it's a rather interesting term,
right?
Because I mean, everywhere, you know, minorities are majorities. Right. And and that in sort of ways becomes a kind of core question of late Ottoman imperial, of the late Ottoman Empire. At what point do, you know, local peoples identify themselves as majorities and therefore have the right for self-determination and therefore have the right to go off on their own apart from the Ottoman Empire? Now, you know, in the whole, though, I think, I mean, you mentioned Germany, and I should say that, you know, this is a quality that isn't inherent necessarily to Turks. I think this is really a phenomenon of urbanization at this period of time. You have to consider that, you know, towns are growing quite a bit. You know, the popular culture is changing rather rapidly. It's becoming more consumer-oriented, more materialistic. And, you know, there was a real sense that among Muslims, not just Turks, among Muslims, that non-Muslims who tended to be longer-term residents in towns and who were more associated with commerce were more in tune to the trends of the day, were not simply wealthier but more sophisticated. And that this held really dire political implications for the, you know, not just for society, but for the Ottoman state as a whole. And that, you know, what you see, and again, you know, kind of if we want to take this thread and kind of pull it to something more contemporary, this is a really central thread that one sees not just in Turkey, but, you know, throughout the Middle East. The idea that through the course of the 20th century, there is a really concerted effort to replace old urban elites, especially those that are non-Muslim, with Muslim, a new class of Muslim elites who would develop their own sense of urbanity, sophistication, but perhaps most of all, acquire the kind of material culture of these older elites, right? They would open theaters. They would be the proprietors of restaurants. They would be the intellectuals. They would be the bankers, the merchants, you know, the big property owners. So, you know, to kind of get to the book, and really it's a theme in virtually all the books I've written, is that this is a big part of the political and cultural and social and economic transformation from the end of empire to, you know, the current, you know, system of nation states that now make up the Middle East and, you know, ostensibly the Balkans as well.
Yeah, it's strange, that sense of 20th century ethnic groups, or what we would now call ethnic groups, defining themselves, making this identity for themselves. And looking at it from the other side, I remember reading a quote from some early Zionist saying that his dream for Israel was to have Jewish policemen arresting Jewish prostitutes, because there was, you know, there was this sense that Jews were disproportionately involved in those entrepreneurial pursuits, and they, you know, it would be somehow comforting to have Jews doing this sort of quasi militarized cop role and this louche demi-monde role as well. So yeah, everybody wants to transfer their identity into something that is possessed by the other group. I remember in Macedonia, because my wife and I spent quite a while in Macedonia, there's a strange sense in Macedonia of identity and whether it can have an identity. They finally capitulated on what I thought they'd never have, which was the name Macedonia. You know, now they're North Macedonia. And yet, they have anxiety about Muslim invasions and all that, but it's never Ottoman. It's always Albanian, as they see it. The Ottomans are strangely forgotten, which was why one of the big revelations from your books that I got was how Balkan the CUP and the young elite was.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that you have to bear in mind, and I'll be honest that, and I would leverage this criticism towards myself, especially in, you know, kind of a lot of the things I wrote in the beginning of my career. I think there's a certain amount of romanticism that we have about the diversity of the past and what we tend to see now as the cosmopolitanism of the past, because it's a lot of it is lost. I mean, it's really funny that you mention it, that, you know, Macedonia is a country where you see shades of it, right? I mean, not just simply in the demographic makeup of the country, but the interactions of people. The fact that, you know, when you meet someone, not necessarily somebody who's Macedonian, but somebody who is Albanian or Turkish, or even somebody who's Roma, I mean, they may speak two or three or four languages. It's kind of astounding. And we have, I think, this effect, and I know for myself, I've developed this affection for Ottoman history precisely because it had that kind of, you know, otherworldly feel that, you know, in some ways that, you know, we imagine as being a positive, at least in our day. Right. But in their day, you know, the way they understood the way the world worked was that nations that knew themselves and that understood what it meant to be as a member of that nation and to define it as tightly as possible was an important step in making that nation strong. And that for the Young Turks in particular, one of the lessons they took from the Balkans is that national pride, as seen among Greeks, as seen among Bulgarians and Serbs, was an important force. In fact, maybe it was the most critical force in the development of those nations and states, right? Mm-hmm. And they didn't see evidence of that among lots of the peoples that they saw as their fellow citizens, or perhaps, you know, put a finer point on it, they're kith and kin, right?
Well, that's a strange. That's another strange thing that seems to come through again and again in your books, that they think of the – there's so much ostensible sympathy for what they call the Anatolian peasantry. But at the same time, just a millimeter under that is this sense that it's a completely inert mass and it will
and
have to
disdain.
Be
– And a real disdain.
Yes, contempt, yes.
Yeah, there's a disdain. And you know, obviously you're jumping around quite a bit time-wise, forgive me, but, you know, you fast forward into the 20s, the 30s, and beyond. You know, one thing that comes across very clearly in the internal records of, you know, interior ministry officials, senior party officials, you know, during the one-party years of Ataturk's rule, is this still this sense of frustration, but real disdain for this peasantry that is supposedly the, you know, the embodiment of the national spirit, right? But that's actually, again, you know, kind of stepping back, this is not all that uncommon, you know, Russians, Russian nationalism is a, you know, alloy made up of pride and self-loathing.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I would say that American nationalism, if you will, is a very similar alloy of pride and self-loathing about, you know, what true American or what any kind of nation really is. You know, you glorify, you know, sort of oftentimes the most humble expressions seemingly of culture, but you really have a disdain for the people who actually are the propagators of that, or the kind of, or the supposedly the repositories of that culture, the kind of the everyday folk, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But I mean, one thing that I think, you know, and I have to say, you know, I'm by no means the first person to point this out. It originally comes about from the observation of Eric Jan Zerker several decades ago that, you know, the Committee of Union Progress, you know, has this schizophrenic crisis, right, with the Balkan Wars, in that it saw the country's future being built through, you know, the taming of the Balkans, and saw the Balkans as kind of the natural core of the state and nation. It's only as a result of the loss of the Balkans in 1912, 1913, that intellectuals are really forced to embrace Anatolia as the national core. Yeah. And one thing that I don't emphasize very much in the fall of the Sultanate, but I do far more in the, you know, my subsequent book, Eternal Dawn, is that even the notion of Anatolia was somewhat nebulous.
Right.
You know, at the turn of the 20th century, where does Anatolia begin and end? Right. It's not clear cut. I mean, and again, to sort of zoom into the present, you know, you talk to anybody in Turkey today, I mean, it is almost like a God-given fact that, you know, that Anatolia begins and ends where the Turkish national borders are drawn. And that's not historically the case. And so
it's almost as if there's this continual sense that Anatolia, as if it had a coastline around a river bend on the east side, is continually being eroded from the east, most of all by Russia, but then with these supposed Russian collaborators in Armenia. And I wonder if that continues today into the sudden demonization of Alevi. Like, you know, I don't see any mention of Alevi as other in the early 20th century, but they seem to be a big target now.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different things. Like, number one, you know, the concept of Anadolu, Anatolia in Turkish, is something that is born in a lot of ways administratively out of the development of the Ottoman Empire. It was originally a province, but it was a province that more or less kind of occupied the lands, let's just say kind of the western third of what is Turkey today, right? Give or take, right? I mean, these things are somewhat, you know, they're not, it's not totally clear cut. And, you know, the concept itself of Anadolu comes from Greek. You know, the word for east in Greek is Anatoli. So, you know, you can sense that, you know, from, you know, where the concept comes from, it's not an inherent ethno-national term, nor is it necessarily a natural geographic term. But to kind of get at where you're going with this, geography becomes important by the 19th, 20th century for Ottoman leaders because of the peril the state finds itself in due to foreign invasion, most notably from the Russians. So that eastern flank in the country is something that, you know, really preys upon the minds of senior leaders and intellectuals. And so to solidify control over this territory wasn't simply something that could be done or can only be done by soldiers, by winning wars. One had to justify the consolidation of state and nation in the eastern throes of the empire. And one of the ways in which this was done, and it was a very slow and sure process, but one that very quickly accelerates in the early 20th century, was the argument that this is the homeland of the Turks. And that the so-called minorities, and here I'm being somewhat fast and loose with some of the details, so forgive me, but, you know, the so-called minorities that, you know, come to be identified with this region, most notably Armenians, although not exclusively Armenians, of course, are people who are undermining what becomes to be a, you know, a kind of state doctrine that this is a part of the national homeland, has always been a part of the national homeland, and these groups are therefore traitors. Mm-hmm. And I think Alevis, you know, for, you know, Ottoman leaders, you know, first of all, I may be wrong, but I cannot think of an Alevi in senior leadership within the middle or upper ranks of the army or bureaucracy during this period of time. The most Alevi were peasants. Many of these of Alevi did not necessarily speak Turkish. Many of them spoke Kurdish, or more specifically spoke Zaza. And they lived in oftentimes very remote places. I mean, there were some places where Alevi lived that were far more, or let's just say kind of closer to urban centers or more, let's say, territorially important, you know, places. But by and large, these were rural folk. These were people who were deemed as really backward. It's only as a result of events subsequent to the fall of the Ottoman Empire, beginning, I would say, especially sort of by the 30s, that Alevi, in many places, come to associate themselves with the state, and more specifically with membership in the Republican People's Party as a means of upward mobility. Mm. Because the party didn't recognize them as being heretics, right? It minimized the fact that they, you know, formed this, you know, kind of unique religious community in Turkey. And so, you know, nevertheless, you know, kind of in now in hindsight, you know, they at times, not always, at times get thrown into this mix of quote unquote minorities that undermine the integrity of state and nation.
Right. So getting back to it again, 1911, 1912, 1913. First of all, quick question. What was it about the Constitution? I mean, what sort of Constitution was it? Was this sort of like a Constitution, like a, how democratic was it? How much power was devolved from it? And then I just wanted to ask about, you know, if you can go into a little bit more detail about the events of 1911, which was Italy's invasion of Libya, which was a part of the Ottoman Empire that meant nothing to these young Turks until that happened, as far as I could tell. And then the Balkan Wars of 1913. So Constitution and then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution is not a very liberal constitution.
Okay.
It's based on the Belgian Constitution. And it's one that does actually award a fair amount of executive powers to the Sultan. But I think it's more symbolically, it represented the possibility of redress, Whereas the previous system, it was just monodirectional. It was what the Sultan said. It was what the capital ordered. People were to follow. Where at the very least, the possibility of something like redress, the formation of a genuine national consensus was, you know, was possible. And in the spirit of 1908, it was more than, I would say, to put a much more narrow fixed point on it. It was perceived as a way specifically of reigning in the rule of Abdulhamid II, the sultan that not only rung in the constitution, but the one who abrogated it. And that this would act as a way of putting the sultan in check, but very specifically Abdulhamid II in check. So, you know, to kind of pair that to, you know, what you're asking about Libya, and Libya actually did matter to the Young Turks in the sense that every kind of square inch of Ottoman territory mattered. Because, I mean, there was a sense that the state had to demonstrate its resolve and its solvency regardless of what quarters you were talking about, if it was to survive. Now,
You see that in almost every nationalism, that the only territory you get sentimental about is the territory that you've lost. Right. Until then, you could, you know, you could go years without thinking about a place.
Yeah, I mean, did you know, the kind of luminaries of the Community of Progress spend night and day before 1911 sort of imagining themselves in Benghazi or Tripoli? No. I mean, it was Siberia. I mean, in fact, this was what it was often referred to colloquially. It was the Ottoman Siberia. Right. But on the other hand, I have to imagine too, and you know, my friend and colleague Mustafa Manawi has written about this quite persuasively and in a very exciting way. And that, you know, this was in essence for a lot of leaders, Libya was an Ottoman colony akin to the ways the British thought about Kenya, or, you know, the ways the French thought about Senegal. It was a place that the Ottomans were going to demonstrate its imperial sophistication, its ability to raise up and civilize otherwise backwards peoples, and bring, you know, kind of the light of good government and urbanity. And so in that sense, it did matter as well. Now, you know, when the Italians do invade in 1911, this rouses something, not just among the Committee of Union and Progress, but among large numbers of people that, you know, this was an unprovoked attack. It was obviously done as a way for the Italians to demonstrate their own sort of superiority. Mm-hmm. Culturally, politically, in the Mediterranean world. And so, you know, this spawns this conflict, which is rather remarkable in that it's a conflict best remembered, perhaps most remembered, for two reasons. One is that it was a conflict led by volunteers, by volunteers from the Committee of Union and Progress, who traveled in rather adventurous ways to Libya, because you have to consider that, you know, there is no direct land bridge between the rump of the Ottoman Empire and Libya at this point. You know, Egypt is a British colony. You know, the Italians controlled the sea. You know, it's not, you know, so it was difficult. But nonetheless, you know, many of these senior leaders do arrive there and actually find some success on the battlefield. And the second reason especially in present day Turkey, why it is remembered is because it is the place where Ataturk first finds himself as a field commander. Mm-hmm. And so this is a place that has a great deal of romance that is attached to it, almost a romance that mimics the sort of romance that's often associated with Lawrence of Arabia, right? Mm-hmm. These officers who come and lead these Bedouin, fighters against, you know, these, you know, untoward invaders.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Libyan War was actually not going badly for the Ottomans, really, and then the Balkan Wars. I mean, it was kind of like at first maybe it wasn't going so well, then, you know, then it seemed to be going better and they were distinguishing themselves. But then the Balkan Wars break out. And, you know, and as we've said, as you said, I mean, the leadership of the Young Turks, the CUP, I mean, they're from the Balkans and they're very Balkan-centric. I don't have that word in front of me now. What's that word you use to describe, it starts with an R, what Turkish Balkans is?
Rumeli.
Rumeli, yes, Rumeli, yeah. So now bring us from Libya, I guess, to the Balkan Wars and what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Balkan Wars, in some sense, comes as a great surprise, and other ways it doesn't. You know, as I'm sure lots of you out there are aware, I mean, the Balkans is a source of considerable, you know, anxiety for Istanbul going back quite a long ways, mm-hmm. for lots of reasons. And so in there, that sense, I mean, it's always been a kind of focal point of different elements of Ottoman policy, both in terms of domestic policy and foreign policy. And among them is the fear that eventually, you know, either a major power or one of the, you know, kind of new neighboring states, you know, Serbia, Bulgaria, Greece, would try to take advantage of the Ottoman Empire and invade. And, you know, one of the things that the Istanbul felt relatively confident about for a very long period of time is that as much as, let's say, you know, Athens or Belgrade or Sofia hoped to conquer Ottoman territory, they did not trust, you know, their neighbors to necessarily put up with any kind of expansion. So there was some sense of confidence in Istanbul that, you know, basically the Balkan states would never get their act together and gang
like
up
like in
on
Reservoir
the
Dogs,
Empire.
Like they're all pointing guns at each other's heads.
And so yeah, no one's gonna there's evidence of this. There's real evidence of this. You know that, you know, going back to the late 19th century, but really intensifying in the years leading up to the Young Turk Revolution. And there is something of a civil war in, you know, in what remains of the Ottoman Balkans. And it's a civil war that's driven largely by paramilitaries funded by, as well as, you know, recruited from Balkan, these neighboring Balkan states. Mm-hmm. So this is not just a hypothetical animosity. This is a very real source of tension between the various Balkan states. But, you know, as fate would have it, you know, these states do form a collective alliance and an agreement to go to war and to partition what remains of the Ottoman Balkans. And so war breaks out in the fall of 1912 amid this campaign, you know, being led in Libya to hold on to these two provinces, which now comprise the state of Libya. And it is a disaster. And it's a disaster in lots of ways that I think is really, you know, quite clear, you know, clearly important to the future of the Ottoman Empire, to, and I would say even kind of the broader makings of the modern Middle East, you know, that number one, the end of Ottoman rule in much of the Balkans. Now, you could sort of say that, you know, Thrace, you know, at least portions of Thrace remain in the Ottoman Balkan, you know, part of the Ottoman Empire, ergo it's, you know, still, you know, Ottoman territory, still part of the Ottoman Balkans. But the loss of most of this territory is psychologically devastating in that, you know, this is arguably both the heart and the soul of the Ottoman Empire. It's not simply the fact that many of the Young Turks came from the Balkans. Right. It's not simply the fact that the Young Turk Revolution, you know, broke out in the Balkans. It was the place where the Ottoman Empire was really founded, right? It's the modus vivendi of the Ottoman state, you know, which is to expand and to expand, you know, into the lands of the old Romans and to some ways accede to the grandeur of the old Roman Empire. You know, this was a, you know, an identity. This was a collective sense of belonging and a sense of history that is rooted in the Balkans, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we often think of, you know, the end of Ottoman rule in the Balkans as a kind of a return to a kind of natural state of being, and that this part of, you know, of the world is a part of Europe, had always been, you know, is historically and geographically part of Europe, and that somehow the end of Ottoman rule is the consummation of this region's Europeanness, right? Senior, you know, senior Ottoman leaders, lots of Ottoman citizens did not see the world in this light, right?
It's strange. Why, you know, when I was preparing for this show, I was looking at maps, Seljuk versus Osman, Ottoman, and really the Seljuk were sort of based in eastern Anatolia. You know, that was their core territory, it seemed like. And to a striking extent, the Ottomans were always looking westward. And it's remarkable to think they were doing the same Third Rome thing that the Muscovites had going for a long time too.
But much later. And I think, you know, the first of all, you know, the, you know, and this is as true in, say, 1912 as it is in 1350. You know, the building of the Ottoman Empire was a collective effort, right? I mean, and I think this is the biggest misconception people have of the Ottoman Empire, is they see it as a Turkish empire, something akin to, say, the British Empire.
Right.
You know, that it was a state run by Turks for the benefit of Turks at the expense of all these other people. And that's far from true, right? In fact, you know, this, you know, idea is very much, you know, it's not necessarily a product of, you know, the contemporary world or kind of contemporary nationalism. It is very much a perception that seems to fit into the way other empires appear to work. But it's not the case, right? That the building of the Ottoman Empire as a state and as a society was a group effort. It was made up of people who were certainly, you know, Turkish-speaking nomads, but also, you know, Serb converts, Serb vassals, Bulgarian vassals, Albanian vassals. I mean, there's a kind of, to borrow a classic American phrase, it was a rainbow coalition of different peoples who maintain the Ottoman Empire. And so the end of Ottoman rule in the Balkans is seen as confirmation that that sort of collective identity, that sense of, you know, kind of territorial wholeness, that's gone, right?
Right, and it seems to feed back into this other thread that you describe associated with the group Turkish Hearth, which harked back to more of a folk ideology of the Turks who are nomadic, who come from Central Asia, and whose germ is the most important thing in identity.
Yeah, it is an idea that is appealing in that it tells a story which is most certainly rooted in some degree of history, but also makes sense as a contemporary identity, right? And that it is, you know, identity, especially in the late 19th, early 20th century, so often the world over is seen as something based in blood, based in culture, based in a kind of origin story of a people, of a coherent people. But the fact of the matter is that the making of Ottoman society, and even moreover, the making of the Ottoman state, is not the story of a single folk, so to speak, right? It's a far more syncretic story and therefore sort of out of sync with modern times. And, you know, to kind of jump ahead a little bit, I mean, when the Ottoman Empire, you know, really breathes its last, right? When it is put out of its misery virtually 100 years ago last month, you know, people, you know, at this moment in time, embrace it as not just something that, you know, happened, but something that should happen, because it was seemed as so archaic. Ottomanness in and of itself felt, you know, given the circumstances of the era, like an anachronism, right? And the beginnings, but the difference between what this you know, in terms of this consensus in 1922 versus in 1912, is that the Young Turks saw Ottomanness as something that could be sculpted into a more coherent nature, right? Through government action, through a variety of different government actions, and among them eventually, and I'm sure this is probably where you want to go, through genocide, right? That this is, you know, that the notion of being Ottoman can be redeemed and refined into something that looked and felt and smelled more like a contemporary nation.
Well, but but also with language, right? Because as you point out many times, Turkish was far from the universal language of the Ottoman Empire. There were lots of languages in lots of different regions. And identity, if I understand right, seems to have been not necessarily associated with language in every sense. You could speak Greek and be an Ottoman. You could lots of different languages.
The issue of whether or not we should see Turkish as a universal language or the empire as a, you know, kind of a symphony of different languages and cultures, it's an issue that one can construe in different ways. You know, Ottoman Turkish, as opposed to, you know, Turkish that exists today, that really is a product of the reforms of Ataturk in the 1920s and 1930s, Ottoman Turkish was the lingua franca of state. It was what official orders were written in. It was, generally speaking, how records were kept. So in some sense, yes, it is a universal language. And it was a universal language not simply for utility purpose, but it was also seemingly a marker of civility. You know, somebody was, you know, refined or sophisticated because they spoke this imperial language, you know, somewhat akin to the ways in which one, say, in the Middle Ages spoke Latin, or in the ways in which Mandarin Chinese served as a marker of civility, as well as obviously a tool to communicate and to integrate, you know, what is a really large and diverse, you know, community of different peoples across a large piece of territory.
Or Russian, like Russian in the Soviet Empire and the Russian
Empire.
Or
even in the Russian Empire. Yeah. You're exactly right. It's exactly right. Although, I mean, here, I mean, the Russian case is a bit of a digression. The Russian case is somewhat of an interesting one in that the Russian elite, especially after the 18th century, spoke French oftentimes as a real marker of civility. Where that wasn't so much the case for Ottoman elites. Now, here this is where it gets, you know, super complicated and convoluted, is that there were, depending on where you were, you know, either parallel languages that marked kind of civility, or, you know, were used in, you know, kind of as a tool for everyday communication, as well as, you know, kind of a, you know, just an expression of local culture, whether that's Arabic or Greek. You know, it is really a complicated one. You know, when we look at the map today and we kind of project on the map, the political map today, ideas of culture and language, the map today doesn't bear any real resemblance to the past. I mean, they don't necessarily even represent even a kind of faint inkling of what would have passed as, let's say, the predominant language or culture of a given state. You know, the idea that, for example, you know, Greek as a language of just the language of Greeks. I mean, well, that's not necessarily the case. Greek was the language of liturgy for large numbers of Orthodox Christians across the Ottoman Empire, bore no relationship to notions of ethnicity or even kind of the ways we think about communal belonging. It was simply the language of literature, and it coexisted, you know, in parallel with, you know, other languages. And that language could be Arabic, that language could be Bulgarian, it could be Albanian, it could be Turkish. And so, you know, when we think about this issue, I mean, what confronted senior Ottoman leaders, in particular, you know, talking about the Young Turks, this incongruence was really, you know, it was frustrating. And it, you know, it represented not something that one would look upon with affection, but really was seen as an obstacle towards building, maintaining a coherent state, forging a coherent and loyal nation. And so from the perspective of the Young Turk regime, and this would be especially the case after 1912, the idea of making, you know, language a primary marker of identity, specifically Turkish, fulfilled both a utilitarian purpose in their mind, but also it represented in their minds a thread of historical and cultural continuity that defined the Ottoman state. The Ottoman Empire was founded by Turks from Central Asia. To their mind, this, you know, was the fragment of culture that, you know, kind of helped give the empire a sense of place in the world. It was a marker of national belonging, of historical significance. And so when we look at the policies after 1912, you know, language is a really important one, right? It's a very, very important one, and will become, you know, will continue to be an important issue going into, you know, the post Ottoman era, post 1922, not just for Turkey, but also for other states too, whether it's, you know, states like Iraq or Syria, but also, you know, states like Greece and Bulgaria, in which, you know, language, you know, the kind of predominance of a single language is, you know, kind of paramount to nation building and state building.
Yeah. And it seems so as they lost this incredibly humiliating, painfully humiliating Balkans war and lost territory, lost what was really the heart, as you've explained, in a lot of ways of the Ottoman Empire, Ottoman culture, and the Young Turks in particular, where they came from. They get more violent, more nationalistic, like Turkish nationalistic in a sense. Again, we've talked about this a lot, defeat and humiliation oftentimes tend to bring out the worst. I mean, a lot of atrocities in history come out of defeated nations. I want to read a little bit here of just an example of sort of the turn of the Young Turks, the CUP leaders. What you write here: as Ottoman armies were defeated at the hands of Greek, Bulgarian, and Serb troops in Macedonia and Thrace, leaders within the CUP agreed that their control over the political direction of the state was slipping from their grasp despite their majority in parliament. On January 23rd, 1913, Enver Pasha, appeared before the Sublime Porte, which is the heart of the capital where the emperor lives.
It's the chief bureaucratic offices of the empire.
Okay, right, okay. In the company of 2,000 to 3,000 men. After rousing the crowd with chants of up with freedom and the committee, down with the tyrants, Enver Talat and a crowd of Young Turks stormed into the empire's main bureaucratic offices, guns in hand. The party confronted the minister of war, Nazim Pasha, and killed him as he exited one of the building's main chambers. So these are the guys who are just about to take over the Ottoman Empire, you know, lead a murder right there in his office, the minister of war. The grand vizier was then cornered at gunpoint, forced to resign. With the resignation declaration in hand, Enver proceeded to the palace where he secured the appointment of a more amiable officer, Mahmoud Shevket. Maybe, is that a
pronounced? Yes, Shevket. Very good.
Pasha, to the post of grand vizier. So, and a little later on, I'll just read this little part here. Losing Rumeli, is that how we pronounce it? Or Rumeli? You're
perfect.
Rumeli, okay. That is Ottoman Balkans, the empire's keystone and the cradle of the CUP, left a wound that radicalized and scarred the country's leadership and permanently undermined what was left of the inclusive and liberal principles of the Young Turk Revolution. The immense scale of the human disaster that followed the Balkan Wars, entailing the greatest mass migration in the empire's history, ensured that the legacies of the conflict would continue to linger well into the Great War and beyond. So this is mass humiliation, wound, radicalization, and this is before the Great War, you know, World War I starts. And then, of course, we'll get into World War I, but you know, I don't know if you want to add anything to that. I don't know if there's much to add to that, but
I think the one thing that I would add only is that, you know, the incident you're citing and this moment that you're citing, you know, that occurs in the winter of 1913 is the so-called Babi Ali coup, or the sublime, it's the coup that's staged by the senior leaders of the party against, you know, what was then a cabinet that served under the Sultan that had decidedly anti-CUP, anti-Young Turk lean in its political orientation. The critical element of this moment, which is really important, not just for the First World War, and not even just for, you know, kind of the final, you know, stages of the empire's collapse between 1918 and 1922, but really kind of endures beyond this, aspects of which continue to this day, which, you know, it was referred to at the time as a kind of fedayeen culture, a chetiji culture. And what these terms are reference to is a fedayee is a fighter. It's sort of coming from Arabic as a fighter for the faith. But in this context, a fedayee or a chetiji, a chetiji means a person who belongs to a gang or a kind of a militant group or militant kind of body of men. It's the idea that, you know, one shows their absolute loyalty to a cause through the act of killing, and the willingness to go to really extreme lengths of violence to save the state, right? So this is what a fedayee is, and what a, you know, the ways in which people thought about what a chetiji was in 1913, and it was very much a Young Turk concept. And it's a concept that becomes really critical to the ways in which this party acts post-1913. If we were to understand how and why the Armenian Genocide happened, if we were to understand how and why a resistance movement meant to save the Ottoman state after World War rears itself in the wake of a really catastrophic defeat, and, you know, last but far, you know, from least, if we look at aspects of militant behavior, not just in the early Turkish Republic, but arguably up to this very day, there is this fetishization of characters, individuals willing to kill, willing to fight and die for the state. And so this is a really important moment in the making of that culture. It's not made as a result of, you know, these events in 1913. There are aspects of it that, you know, manifest themselves, you know, going back to the time of the Young Turk Revolution in 1908. But it's crystallized at this point, and it becomes a really important feature of, you know, the history of the Ottoman Empire in its last years. And again, you know, in Republic of Turkey as well.
That reminds me so much of what happened to the Russian ambassador in Istanbul, Andrei Karlov. He was killed by, I think, one of his own Turkish bodyguards at this event. And
Recently in 2015?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the guy did not behave like most assassins. He's this well-dressed, sane-looking young man, and he stands over the body and waves his hand in the air, making a proclamation. And you have to assume, you know, he's sacrificing his life to destroy the enemy of the nation.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of these kinds of characters that you find in contemporary Turkish politics. I mean, it is something that is very much fetishized within the, I guess, what you would call the Turkish right. And it's something that is a big part of the popular culture as well. The idea of the killer, the hitman, the hatchet man who fights, suffers, endures, kills in the name of the state. It's a really powerful and emotive character in the culture.
I have to ask then, I know we're going to turn this into two episodes because this is such a great, and we have so much to talk about, but maybe this will be one of the kind of bridges. This concept of Ferin, does this have anything to do with the creation of the special organization?
Oh, absolutely.
This death squad sort of.
Yes, yeah. Okay. Right, exactly. And, you know, I mean, what you're alluding to, this organization, which, you know, is loosely referred to as Teshkilat Ma'asusa, or special organization, which, you know, I say loosely because it goes through a couple of name changes, you know, kind of a prince-like metamorphosis over time in terms of how it's, you know, what its moniker
is. The organization formerly known as the special organization.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, it serves lots of different purposes. I mean, it's perhaps most known, it's most notorious for the role in which its members would play within the Armenian Genocide, mm-hmm. but it functions in lots of different ways. I mean, it's a kind of espionage organization. It's a it's a kind of catch-all organization aimed at subterfuge, both domestically and internationally. And it's a creation, you know, bureaucratically of, to some degree, the Turkish Ottoman Ministry of, the Ottoman Ministry of War, but also of the Committee of Union and Progress. It is both a kind of formal ministry, but also an extension of the party unto itself, and represents in a lot of ways the extent to which the party becomes a kind of state within a state by 1912, 1913. And again, this really quite dramatic fetishization of paramilitarism and of, you know, of extreme measures. And it's something that is born both, again, out of domestic experiences, specifically the development of the Committee of Union Progress itself as a clandestine organization, but the ways in which Ottoman leaders looked abroad and admired a lot of the revolutionaries of the late 19th and early 20th century. Mm-hmm. You know, these, you know, individuals who brought about, you know, let's say, you know, the creation of the state of Bulgaria, you know, which was very much done as a sort of subversive paramilitary sort of movement. Clandestine movements in Russia, you know, most certainly are, you know, the, you know, a kind of model for this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, within
Imro,
the context of
the Macedonian.
Internal Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, most definitely. I mean, it was a kind of model for it.
I wonder, because often in when an insurgent movement arises in one community, it gets mirrored in the other, even if they're bitter enemies. So I can't help thinking of Miloš Obilić, the Serb who killed the Sultan. It didn't do any good, as it happened, but he did kill him right at the beginning of the Battle of Kosovo.
Right, but I mean, this is centuries earlier. I mean, we're in the early 20th century. There is a kind of a beginnings of a culture of paramilitarism or subversive
and clandestine
movements.
And so under Western eyes, Conrad's novel, that kind of thing. Right?
You know, that kind of anarchist, you know, the anarchists, you know, for example, the late 19th, early 20th century, the Russian revolutionary movements.
Of course.
All of these, you know, but more specifically, you're right, the Balkan movements are kind of something closer to home, and it has a more immediate resonance, as well as, you know, groups like the Jacobins, you know, that the Young Turks did, you know, admire the kind of militancy and devotion of, you know, the most radical of the French revolutionaries, as a lot of revolutionaries of this time did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think in that immediate context, I mean, it's what's fascinating is the extent to which this culture really endures, you know, decades, you know, later, and becomes a really important part of a broader story in the former Ottoman world. I mean, if you're going to draw a more contemporary example, you know, if you look at Arkon's paramilitaries during the Yugoslav Civil War, even, you know, the Kosovo Liberation Army is in a way, and as it would be referred to in Turkish, it would be a Çeteci movement. It was a movement of armed bands aimed at political, specifically at a political goal. So, you know, all said and done, I mean, there's a lot of continuity here in and beyond Turkey.
Right. Yeah, we did a couple episodes on the Serbian Red Berets, which Arkon was connected with, and their murky relationship with the minister, it was either like the head of their intelligence, or I can't remember right now, minister of war under Milosevic, and how they, you know, that murky relationship is also important. And the makeup of these people, I mean, a lot of them are released criminals and bandits, but they do an important, for the state, at least the state believes, an important job. I mean, the Young Turks in particular seemed really enamored with them as a force that was able to do things compared to the regular army, which they saw as kind of pathetic in the Balkan Wars. Isn't that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, when we look at, you know, kind of again, sort of the why this stuff matters is that the sort of this tendency towards extremism, but also mass, more importantly, mass violence, it has a genealogy, but it has a genealogy that is made up of lots of different threads. There's an ideological component. There's an issue of mobilization. There is a certain amount of valor that is associated with it, in which this kind of stock figure plays a really important role, the fedayi or the chetiji. And so, you know, this, you know, kind of force is what is so, you know, these kind of collection of forces, I should say, kind of plays such a really pivotal role in understanding the violence of this time.
So before we get to our next episode, the last thing I want to bring up, and then so that we can start up the next episode right with really with World War One and the beginnings of it for the Ottoman Empire, is sort of 1913, 1914. I mean, after a series of massacres of Armenian Christians and really the falling out between the AFU, which had been aligned with the Young Turks, the AFU, the Armenian, was it again, the Armenian?
ARF.
The ARF, Revolution, I'm sorry.
The Revolutionary Federation.
AFU, yes. Yes. Yeah, I was thinking Armed Forces
of
Ukraine.
If you're linguistically AFU. Adventurous, you can call it the Dashnak Sutun. That's its Armenian name.
Do you speak Armenian?
No.
Okay. But you know Turkish. No, it's really impressive. I mean, I got to say. It's like, right? You know Turkish.
Yeah. No, but Armenian is a bridge.
Totally that, different, yeah.
it seems a bit far.
Yeah. But anyway, so the last thing I want to bring up, so there was violence, there were precursors. I mean, that had been really going on since, in a pretty bigger way, since the 1890s, but it really heated up in sort of 1912, 13, 14. And out of that, in the, you know, with the Ottoman Empire at its weakest point before World War One, the Ottomans have to kind of submit to a treaty imposed on them by the Entente powers. I don't think Germany was part of this, where Entente observers would be, French and primarily, I guess, French and British would be put in the areas where the Armenians were, where there'd be sort of, they would redraw the boundaries of the regions where the Armenians were within the Ottoman Empire. And even the whole notion of crimes against humanity as a crime kind of came out of this. But then the Entente just sort of dropped it. But can you explain what happened there? Because it was also another moment of rage for this group of people, right?
Right? I mean, you're almost there. I mean, it's basically, you know, so in 1878, the Ottoman Empire signs this treaty, the Treaty of Berlin, which ends a war that the Ottoman Empire fights with Russia between 1877 and 1878. And among the stipulations of the treaty was a so-called reform agenda for Eastern Anatolia. And it was aimed at redress for Armenian, longstanding Armenian grievances in, you know, Ottoman territory, most notably, and I believe this is something we talked about before, kind of the lack of representation within the local administration, local, you know, kind of language and cultural rights, an end of raiding and violence on the part of predatory tribes and communities. You know, those sort of a host of things. And this was an agreement Istanbul signs at Berlin, and was overseen by the great, you know, kind of by a collection of great powers. The Entente didn't quite exist yet.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, most notably Russia, Britain, in particular. Although, I mean, it's a community of different you know, European states that, you know, helped broker this agreement. And, you know, the implementation of this clause is, let's just say it's a little slow going up until 1913. And, you know, with the end of the Balkan Wars, the, you know, Armenian representatives, again, with the, you know, backing of major European powers, Britain and Russia in particular, it, you know, raise and reassert the, you know, these demands and for the full implementation of this reform agenda. And so in 1913, 1914, Istanbul again comes to a kind of a new agreement with, you know, major European powers for a broad program of reform that would be overseen by a Western representative, in fact, a Dutch representative. You know, it's kind of a non-power would be kind of the main overseer of this reform agenda. And it would lead to a degree of autonomous status within Eastern, let's say Eastern Anatolia or Eastern part of Turkey. And it would especially privilege Armenians. And, you know, this in some ways is in reference to a pattern of cooperation and even coordination between the Committee of Union Progress and the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, or otherwise known as the Dashnak Sutun, which is a the largest of the Armenian nationalist organizations, not just operating in the Ottoman Empire, but in Russia as well. And, you know, they, so a long story of how and why this comes to pass, that the two sides, you know, do coordinate with one another. But this is a moment of real rupture for Ottoman senior leaders, you know, especially, again, senior CUP leaders, where, you know, at the moment of greatest weakness, the ARF, or seemingly Armenians in general, decide to take advantage of the Ottoman state. And seemingly weaken it further. And the it should be said that this program of reform for Eastern Anatolia was similarly imposed over the Southern Balkans after 1878 as well. And in the mind of senior, you know, CUP leaders, the linkages are quite clear to them, or at least they seem rather clear. What was happening in Eastern Anatolia in 1914 was a replay of what had happened preceding the Balkan Wars. And so to their mind, you know, the path ahead seemed relatively clear if nothing was done, that Eastern Anatolia in some way, shape, or form, by some means, would spin out of control of the Ottoman state. And so, you know, leading up to the outbreak of war, the Ottoman entrance into war in the summer of 1914, and it's sort of the first, you know, inklings of fighting in the fall of 1914, we begin to see CUP leaders begin to institute plans that are, in hindsight, look really ominous. You know, for example, they start conducting demographic surveys of of the East. You know, the point of those surveys are not necessarily clear to those who are even conducting those surveys at the time, but it seems relatively persuasive that these were surveys that eventually aided in the, you know, the mass deportation of Armenians in 1915. And so, there is a, you know, this is a critical, again, sort of data point of how and why, you know, we get to the Armenian genocide, you know, amid the First World War.
Yeah, that's a good point also about, I mean, the surveys laying the groundwork. I mean, a friend of the show, journalist Yasha Levine, has written a lot about how census taking also, or census technologies were used for similar purposes. I mean, it, you know, the Nazis famously hired IBM to study demographics for obviously evil purposes. The two don't have to go hand in hand, but when you see the two, you see the census taking followed by the genocide and the ethnic cleansing, you know, it's pretty clear that, yeah, it's probably one preparing for the other.
And this is one of the real kind of, you know, mysteries surrounding the Armenian genocide. It's among the murkier things is, at what point is a decision made? Is it, you know, is it something that is purely contingency driven, or is there some sort of kind of pre, you know, hatched idea that is implemented with the First World War. And, you know, frankly, it is a difficult question to really, to answer and unpack, because the records of the CUP were destroyed at the end of the First World War. And what we have is kind of fragmentary evidence that, you know, speaks to both a kind of sense of contingency, but also, I think, some inkling that there was some plan that was in some sort of genesis phase, you know, going into the First World War.
In some ways, I mean, to finish this up, but in some ways, the Nazis, Hitler, kind of distorted our expectations of how genocides should work, because they were so open and clear and central about it. But a lot of genocides are actually develop, right, in the kind of series of things. Whereas the Nazis were just, they're very unusual in a lot of ways in their evil stupidity. But, they're like, we want to exterminate these people. I mean, they were very clear. The whole ideology was based on that, but that it's not always quite that clear. There have been a lot of genocides, and they didn't necessarily have some people dressed up in uniforms issuing, whole manifestos for genocide. They were carried out usually secretly and clandestinely, with the records burned afterwards as well.
Yeah, those records were burned by the Young Turks themselves, if I recall.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, what sort of the received wisdom of the time. We don't actually know the circumstances around their loss. We've seen in the last, several years, some recovery of documents, most notably, I want to say it's about 5 to 10, less than 10 years ago, this very popular Turkish historian, a guy by the name of Murat Bardakçı, published, what was called, the title of the book was called Talat's Lost Notebooks. And these were evidently notebooks that were found in some trunk somewhere that belonged to the Minister of Interior, Talat Pasha, from the First World War. And in it were maps and orders, as well as records, like census data type records, that were referential to the Armenian genocide. So, it's clear perhaps that not everything was lost. I mean, maybe, somewhere out, in the wider world in a trunk, there's more stuff, but there's no sort of, what is clear is that a centralized repository of the CUP does not exist anymore. And that even the Ottoman archives that exist today in Istanbul don't necessarily account for every possible piece of paper produced from this period.
And as you said, the CUP was a state within a state. So so I think this is, this is all grim enough as it is, but I think it's a good place to end part one of our series with Ryan Gingras on the last years of the Ottoman Empire. So let's end it here, and then we'll come back with part two, which is going to be World War I and the aftermath and the War for Independence.